Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. Well, a little physics here. 100 years ago, Albert Einstein published his general theory of relativity, which you may have heard of. And under this theory, space and time are interwoven into something called space-time, which adds a fourth dimension, or time, to our concept of the universe, in addition to the usual 3D physical perception of it that we see as far as, you know, length, width, and depth. And a key part of Einstein's theory was his prediction that mass warps space-time through its gravitational force, and that when objects with mass accelerate or move toward each other, they generate gravitational waves that propagate outward like ripples in a pond would. But this prediction wasn't proven at the time, and it wasn't even provable really at the time because it requires extremely sensitive instruments that didn't even remotely exist. And Einstein had doubts that it could ever be proved by direct observation. In fact, by the 1930s, I think he even had doubts about his own theory. But it was central to the overall premise of relativity. And other parts of the theory were being experimentally proven as time went on. So, starting in the 1970s, the U.S. National Science Foundation in Washington, which funds university basic research, began funding a search for proof that gravity waves exist. And the centerpiece of that search was the building of two large detectors, one in Louisiana and one in Washington State, called Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, or LIGO, to detect these waves. So there were two LIGOs built, if they did exist, if the waves did exist, that is. Finally, on September 14th, 2015, they detected one of these waves. And after spending some time confirming what they'd found, the researchers announced it on February 11th, 2016. This was a major scientific breakthrough in astronomy and physics. A lot of you may have heard of it and not understood what it was, so we're going to try to explain more about what that is and what it means here. Some have even compared it to Galileo's use of the telescope to examine the heavens for the first time. I mean, it's a big deal in astronomy and physics. My guest is Professor Guido Müller, who is a professor of physics at the University of Florida. He spent nearly 20 years working on LIGO. Professor Müller is an expert on the LIGO detector and in the astrophysics involved in the detection itself. Welcome, Professor Müller.
Hello.
Nice to have you on. Can we call you Guido?
Yes, absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
I appreciate you being on. So how does LIGO work?
So how does it work? So we have several ways to explain this. I started thinking about this again over the last days. And the way I try now is if we put a beam splitter somewhere to split a strong laser beam into two beams, then imagine that one of the beams travels to the north and the other one to the east. Now we drew a third circle with a radius of 4 kilometers around the beam splitter and place a mirror at each location where the laser beams intercept that circle. And then we send the beams back to the beam splitter. If everything is perfect, the two beams will reach the beam splitter exactly the same time, or as we say, the beams are perfectly in phase or synchronized with each other. That's your interferometer. Now, if a gravitational wave comes by, it will deform the circle. It forms into an ellipse by squeezing one arm and stretching the other, and this changes the time the light needs to travel back to the beam splitter. So the beams become out of sync, out of phase, and this is exactly what LIGO measures.
The detector at the vertex where these two arms meet suddenly sees that the two beams are slightly out of sync and goes, whoop, okay, I see one. So why are there two LIGOs? Why did it take two of these big expensive devices to capture and prove gravitational waves exist?
Now, so there are essentially two reasons. The first one is that many, many other things squash in this sense, a circle, or change the distances between the beam splitters and two mirrors. Right? There's ground noise, ground motion, and so on. So these local disturbances will not be identical at the two sites, which are separated by 2,000 miles, but the gravitational waves which pass through Earth unobstructed, they will be identical at the both sites. So signals will be absolutely identical, and that will help us to rule out any artificial signals from ground motion. So the detectors confirm each other, essentially, in this sense. Furthermore, the multiple detectors give us strong information about the source location, right? If you have just one single detector, you have just one ear, essentially, you don't know where the noise is coming from. But with two detectors, you can actually start triangulation. Now, for triangulation, you really need three, but with two, we can actually at least roughly figure out where the signal came from.
What phenomenon out in the universe did you detect with the ground wave that you had measured?
So in plain numbers, the source was a merger between two black holes. One had a mass of 36 times the sun, the other one of 29 times the sun. They're fairly large black holes in the sense that we had astronomers that only observed black holes out to 10, 15 solar masses, and then in addition, the big black holes in the centers of galaxies, so 10 to the 6 to 10 to the 8 solar masses, they're much, much bigger. So these two solar masses, 36 times, 29 times the mass of the sun, fell into each other with relative speed of approaching the speed of light at that moment. And the end product was then a black hole with a mass of 62 times the sun. So it's really huge. And if you do the math, 35 plus 29 is not 62. Those three solar masses are missing, and they were radiated away in the form of gravitational waves. And this happened within a few hundred milliseconds, around 1.3 billion years ago.
Oh my God.
It's like a blink of an eye and happened way, way in the past.
How far away were these two black holes that merged?
Yeah, 1.3 billion years is 1.3 billion light years. And that's very, very far away. So this is well beyond our galaxy, beyond our local group. And I would have to do the math, to be honest, to get you the real answer in miles or kilometers. It's a gigantic number. Telescopes from this distance barely see the shape of a galaxy, for example. They will never be able to resolve this. It's extremely far away.
How did you know when the two LIGO detectors detected what appeared to be a gravitational wave? How did you know first that it was a gravitational wave for sure? I guess it was because they both detected the same thing at the same time, maybe.
Yeah.
But then how did you know that it was from the merger of two black holes as opposed to some other supernova or some other big event?
Yeah, honestly, the coincidence is not the only one we have. There are sometimes glitches in the detectors, and you have coincidence glitches in the detectors. So there's more to that story. One is that we had the right waveform. Gravitational waves from these mergers have very specific rate waveforms. So the signal starts essentially with very low amplitude and low frequencies, twice the orbital period of the two black holes. And that's in frequency space well beyond what, well below what advanced LIGO will ever hear. But as time goes by, the two systems, the system loses energy, and the two stars and black holes in this case get closer and closer and orbit around each other faster and faster. And then the generated gravitational waves will increase in amplitude and frequency. And we actually detect the last few hundred milliseconds of this process. And there's a very characteristic time dependence of these type of signals, or the signals a very characteristic shape. It exactly fitted our model, our models of these signals. And this is then the smoking gun, essentially. So you have coincidence, you have a perfect fit of the models, and this is essentially what we're always looking for. And the signal to noise was actually gigantic, much, much bigger than the typical coincidence glitches that we occasionally see in the detectors.
This was a long, long way away, and even though you detected the signal, it must have been quite weak by the time it got to these detectors on Earth. So how big are the waves? How big a signal did you get, and how fast do these waves travel?
So let's start with the fast travel. So according to general relativity, the waves travel the speed of light. So I'm not really an expert on general relativity and can't really say how much our results confirmed this or how much we actually use general relativity to actually detect our signals and assume that this is actually the waveform, the exact waveform that we see. But that's catch 22 a little bit in there. But we can certainly say that the data is absolutely consistent with general relativity, can fully be explained by general relativity. And in that case, the gravitational waves travel with the speed of light, and I don't have any doubt that they travel with the speed of light. Now, how big are the waves is the question, what do you mean with big? Hmm. If you're only interested in the length changes that we saw in these 4-kilometer detectors, it was just a few atom meters, or a millionth of a millionth of a millionth of a yard. Close your eyes. Imagine a yard or a meter.
Oh my gosh.
And then divide this in a million pieces. And that is essentially put your thumbs together as close as you can and just barely see light coming through there. That's about a micrometer. Then divide this by a million. And then you are below the size of the atom. And then divide this by another million. And then you have your atom meter. Right? This is essentially how sensitive these instruments are. Now, people try to put some scales on this. The one I like most is measure the distance from here to the sun by the diameter of an atom. But in reality, you can't put this in any terms humans, and including our scientists, can truly understand. Right? We can't really imagine the size from here to the sun. We work with these numbers all the time. We can't imagine the size of the atom, although we work with these numbers all the time, but we're also humans. Right? This is too small for us to really imagine. These are numbers on a sheet of paper at the end. There's no real scale that you can really use to measure these things. I think the best way is really look at that meter and divide it 3 times by 1,000,000.
That's incredible to me that there are sensors so sensitive, detectors so sensitive that they would pick up something that's 1/1,000,000 of an atom across. I mean, that's amazing. How is the signal displayed? I mean, how do you get the signal that there has been a detection?
Before I come to this, let me make one more point, right? If you think about this in terms of energy, you have to keep in mind that you have to know that space is actually very stiff. So it costs a lot of energy to deform the space itself. Mm-hmm. Like we talked about these three solar masses that were essentially disappeared and were turned into gravitational radiation. Right? This is the most energetic event we ever observed. Mm-hmm. So you talk about the size of the waves in terms of energy, this is gigantic. But there's kind of this notion that there's very small changes in space. At the same time, there's a lot of energy coming out. It's mind-boggling if you compare these two ideas. Now, what's the question? How was the signal displayed? You have to imagine the signal, essentially from the final photodetector, was detected in each LIGO individually. So we take measure the number of photons that essentially leave the interferometer, and then we look for fluctuations in the photocurrent. And in this particular case, the signal was already visible in the simple data stream. Right? But as I said before, it lasts only 150 to 200 milliseconds, and there's no human sitting there observing this data stream directly all the time. Right? He blinks his eye and the signal is gone. We can't have that happening. Mm-hmm. So there are data analysis programs running in the background. So in this particular case, it was data analysis program we call Coherent Wave Burst, which analyzed the data streams online. And then within 3 minutes, essentially identified the signals as a black hole mergers between two roughly 30 solar mass black holes. They were coming from somewhere in the southern hemisphere, calculated signal to noise ratios and so on. So it's online data analysis that always looks at these signals. And this one actually triggered and sent out the alert to scientists who have the role of monitoring these channels. So they got an email then notified about the detection of that signal.
I have seen it described, and I've actually heard it online as a sound. So I guess that the signal was converted then to audible form so that it could be presented to an audience and people could hear it, and even scientists can hear it. Is that right?
Yes. So we do that for various reasons. Right. So for our analysis, we certainly don't need to turn this into an audio sound. We take the data streams, the data itself, and analyze this mathematically. Right? So there's nobody doing this with audio directly. Okay. But it's very intriguing for the public, and part of this is public outreach too. I mean, we remember that, for example, the public pays for all these detectors and all these discoveries. These are not only our discoveries, they're the discoveries of the entire United States and all the other countries that actually spend money on it. And making it audible is, I think, very nice because people start to hear this, have a much better feeling of what happens. We had this in the past, connect the photodetector signal to speakers and played that in the control rooms and the LIGO sites. And sometimes I believe they still do that. But after a while, it gets pretty annoying because of this noise that's always in the background. And so we actually start turning this off. And once we have a detection, then we go take the waveform and play it then again for us or also for the public. You can certainly get this on YouTube now all these days. Just Google it and you find it.
Yeah, I was going to say, you can go to YouTube and just Google gravitational wave sound and you'll hear it. It's been described as a chirp, but when I listen to it, it sounds more like a burp, honestly, than a chirp. But it's, you know, it's kind of a low sound. It's like boom, like that. But that's interesting. It's, you know, there's nothing.
The reason for that is actually that we typically expected, especially in initial LIGO, or hoped, I should say hoped, because we didn't really expect much, hoped in initial LIGO to see neutron star mergers. These are much smaller objects, and their frequencies would be higher. And that sounds much more like a chirp than this burp. These very heavy black holes, they merge at lower frequencies, and that makes it more like this, what you said, it's a burp instead of a chirp.
Okay. Glad we got that straightened out. But so you weren't looking then for that particular kind of wave from a black hole at that particular time. I mean, it was just basically the detectors are set up there, and they catch what comes in. It sounds like there's a complex software algorithm that analyzes the signal and determines what the generator must have been that resulted in that wave, right?
Yes, this is essentially right. We turn this on, we turn the machine on, and then we have to wait. There's no early warning system or anything like this. These waves just travel through the universe, and at one point they go through us, and we detect them with our detectors, or we detected one reflections on our detector so far. We hope we have a lot more to come.
Mm-hmm.
Then it's gone, right? It's in this sense, it's probably it's comparable to a supernova, right? Mm-hmm. This explodes, you get the light burst, essentially with the telescopes, and then it's gone.
So, I mean, a single pulse of a passing gravitational wave was detected in this case. And can each big event out there in the universe or in the universes that generates gravitational waves be detected only once, or do they reverberate around in space and pass through the detector more than once eventually?
No. Once a signal is recorded, and whatever we missed from it will be gone forever. So it's not going to come back. We will really have to wait for more mergers and other events which emit gravitational waves to become detected. For this particular event, this is it. There's nothing else coming anymore. So the data is in the can. We have to take it and analyze it, understand it.
Okay. So these waves aren't like ocean waves coming in and hitting a rock cliff and bouncing off. They don't bounce off solid objects. They just pass on through and keep going.
Yep. It's much more like a waterfall. They go over the cliff and are gone.
Okay. So you mentioned, I'm interested in what other celestial phenomena can they detect. And so we talked about black holes and supernovae. Are there other things you're likely to detect beyond those?
Yeah, so let me start with a supernova, right? So they are typically detected by telescopes these days.
Hmm.
We also believe that, or hope that, we will see supernovae at one point. The problem with supernovae is that if it's a perfectly symmetric, the star is a sphere. If it's a perfectly symmetric explosion, there wouldn't be any gravitational waves generated.
Hmm.
You need something that is asymmetric. Now, explosions typically are asymmetric. They're not that symmetric, but we have no idea really, or no good understanding about the scale of the asymmetry. So we don't really understand the magnitude or amplitudes of the gravitational waves coming out of supernovae. There are estimations, calculations, but we don't really have a very good handle on it. So we assume if a supernova goes off in our Milky Way, which happens roughly every 30 years, or in Andromeda Galaxy, which happens a couple more times, we will see it. If it's further away, we probably have a hard time finding it. Although if we see it with optical telescopes, we have a good hint when to look in our data streams, so that might help. But it will be tricky. The other objects we are really truly after are then mergers of neutron stars, for example, and then mergers from black holes. So the LIGO detectors are sensitive in the 10 hertz to few kilohertz frequency range. If you took a little more than first year physics, you had probably heard about Kepler's laws and Newton. And you can actually use Kepler's laws to calculate the frequencies, roughly speaking, of these binary systems fairly well. Right? That's fairly straightforward. And you can see that a frequency window from 10 hertz to a few kilohertz makes it sensitive to black holes up to about 100 solar masses. And then neutron stars at the other end, about one solar mass. They are the low mass ends of these objects, and we would try to hope to see mergers of those in all mass scales in this entire mass range over the next couple of years. The neutron star ones we are particularly interested in to also study their equation of state, to study how the neutron star actually is really built up. So far we see things from the outside, obviously, and we can't look into a neutron star. This will give us some indication of how a neutron star actually is built in its inside.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Professor Guido Müller, who's at the University of Florida. He's a physics professor, and he is a member of the team that recently made basically an historic, earth-shaking, literally, discovery of gravitational waves, which proved a missing piece of Albert Einstein's general theory of relativity. And this is a very big deal in astronomy and physics. So how important, Guido, is this discovery really? I mean, I said earlier that it's been compared to Galileo using a telescope to look at stars and planets and for the first time. Is that comparison even remotely reasonable? Is it in that scale of importance scientifically?
Yeah, so my friend and the LIGO director, David Reitze, used that, and I was wondering when I get this question.
Okay.
About Galileo. So how important is this discovery? I think the discovery itself is outrageously interesting and important, and everybody is talking about this in the physics world. This is not only the first time we have seen gravitational waves. It's also the first time we found black holes in this mass range, right?
Hmm.
This is the first time we detect a merger of these black holes. This is the most energetic event ever recorded in human history outside of the Big Bang, as far as I know. And all this just after we switched on our detectors. we use telescopes since 400 years and never saw anything as powerful as this really. So it is gigantic. It is really important. It is a new type of a new way to look or to listen to the universe. It's better place. Now, how does this compare to Galileo's telescope? I mean, I could say that we have seen stars even before Galileo pointed his telescopes to the stars.
Sure.
But we never heard the universe talk to us, right? So we could claim it even beats Galileo, but that's probably really overstating it by quite a bit. The vast majority of our knowledge about the universe comes from telescopes, and that will continue to be the case. Right? They look in many, many different spectral ranges, and gravitational wave astronomy will probably not beat that. We look at things telescopes can't really look at, while they look at other things. However, we are just at the beginning with gravitational wave astronomy, and we'll see what comes next. Right? We don't really know, but it is a big event. It is very, very important.
Well, I guess another way of asking that, and maybe the big question is, how much more can it tell us about the universe that we don't already know?
Certainly quite a lot. So when you look at pictures taken with telescopes, they either show stars mostly in our own galaxy or nearby galaxies, or further away, you have essentially entire galaxies, which are a couple of spots on a CCD chip. So they don't really resolve that. So if you would try to look at these binary system that we just discovered with LIGO, it's so far away, a telescope will have no chance to ever resolving this. There's no way. So they just get a flash of light from an event like this, if they ever get a flash of light from an event like this, because black holes are black. So you would have to steer up something in the outer skirts of the black holes, and you see a flash of light, but you don't really know what the source of this is. Right? So the black hole mergers are something that we can really only detect with gravitational waves. Clearly detect with gravitational waves, measure their masses, spins, and so on. So it gives us access to types of sources we have a very hard time to identify with standard telescopes, especially further away. Now measuring these black holes, measuring how many exist, how many merge, will tell us how many exist, what rotations they have, so they spin around on their own. This spin, if it's large, and it's probably the black hole probably grew through accreting gas from the outside. If it's smaller, then there are ideas out there, theories out there that they grew from mergers. So this tells us a lot about the growth history of these black holes, where they come from, where they origin, and so on. So this is certainly one of the things. And we study neutron stars, equation of state. I mentioned that already. So these are the things we are really after, getting a good understanding of where the black holes come from, how they grew. Later on, and I mean in the future, we are looking at space missions, hopefully at one point, where we start looking at much heavier black holes, into the fourth, into the sixth, into the eighth solar mass black holes, the ones that are in the centers of our galaxies, and they are directly related to galaxy formation. So we'll learn something about how galaxies work. We don't really understand the structure of the universe right now. I think black hole, the gravitational wave astronomy will play a major role in finding out how the universe evolved and how it came into the shape that it is now.
Yeah, so it's a whole new medium, really, for looking at the universe. But this does sound like it's pure science, just for the sake of adding to humanity's understanding of nature and the universe, which is a good thing. I mean, it's what separates us from the other mammals, is that that's something that humanity does pursue. And, learning the way the world and nature and the universe work is a very valuable thing in and of itself. But I do want to ask the question, are there potentially any practical implications for day-to-day human life, or even big technological projects? I don't know, I'm thinking of satellite communications or anything like that, potentially coming from our ability to detect gravitational waves.
So that's probably answer was, I'm sure the government will find a way to tax it, right? That was the answer Faraday gave many years ago, 150 years ago,
right.
Talked about electromagnetic waves, but they're probably not going to tax it. So this is pure science. There is no direct applications of gravitational waves other than observing it, absorbing, using them to observe these mergers, supernova explosions, other things in the universe. It is astronomy and astrophysics. However, the advanced light detectors are the most sensitive instruments ever built, right? We talked about the attometer sensitivity. This is essentially a signal that only lasts for milliseconds. It's incredibly detective. So the development process of the design, the manufacturing, the testing, installation, commissioning, has trained many scientists and graduate students and also engineers at US companies for the last 20 years. Right? This is something new, and we develop in this context human capital, if you want to put it into these terms, which is also one of the responsibilities, I think, for of the National Science Foundation, right? So human capital is a reason U.S. is leading in many, many areas, and also in these technologies. And I think, to some extent, Advanced LIGO has participated in this. And this is kind of the beauty of working for the National Science Foundation, right? The National Science Foundation is dedicated not only to the absolute forefront of science, but also to the education of the next generation, right? They, if you write a proposal, they want to see graduate students being involved. A lot of our work would become much easier if you just do it with senior scientists and engineers. We don't have to train them over and over again. But on the other hand, you don't generate trained scientists that go later on into industry or academia or other areas to ensure that there's progress in our society. Right? So I think there's a lot to be said about the National Science Foundation and also LIGO's role in training young scientists to learn, gain experience, mature. And it's also an atypical project for university researchers, right? Because you're project driven, which is what you face a lot more in industry. And I think it's also a good experience for the students to learn this and be involved in something like this.
Okay.
So I think there's a lot of things coming out of this.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. That's a good answer. So very quickly now, what do you think of Einstein now that all parts of his theory have been proven?
So I think we have discovered gravitation waves. That helps quite a bit. But I think we are still quite a bit away from testing relativity and the strong field regime. Right? The signal to noise is not as good as we would like to have it on the long run to really prove that general relativity is the ultimate theory, even when at the moment the two black holes collide. But there's the signal to noise is not just there. But I love that the science that he has produced. This is just one of the most amazing people that ever walked on Earth.
Yeah, 100 years ago to envision in your own single mind what you have discovered.
Yes.
100 years later, teams of hundreds of scientists, is incredible. Well, we are getting a little short of time. You mentioned a satellite-based observatory. If you can answer just quickly, we've got a minute or so left. Guido, what's the plan for detecting gravitational waves using satellites in space?
Yeah, there was an OLISA project which got canceled essentially because of funding issues. And right now the Europeans are taking over the leadership in this area, and they are planning a space mission called ELISA for their third large mission slot, and it's currently scheduled for 2034. There are two other missions before that, so large missions. So given our experience, so this will probably not launch before 2040. But the Europeans are leading it, and NASA is not heavily involved at this stage. It's playing junior partner at the 10% level right now, and we'll see if we can increase this over time. But they also have other projects out there which are very, very important and very good. Right? So it's an expensive world we live in.
Yep, it's an expensive game to play, and it's downstream,
yes.
It sounds like. Well, Professor Guido Müller, I want to thank you so much for being on with us. It's been fascinating, and congratulations on the discovery your team has made.
Yes, thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.